what's been a somewhat mysterious connection and relationship between Grassmannians and scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 super Yang mills for now in the planar limit. And the basic connection is on the left-hand side, we have scattering amplitudes defined ultimately from some Lagrangian using Feynman rules. We can compute gluon scattering amplitudes by summing tree diagrams, one-loop diagrams, two-loop diagrams, and so on. In the supersymmetric theory, the amplitudes are labeled by the number of external particles and also by this variable k, which tells you in a given superamplitude the purely gluonic amplitudes in a superamplitude, the number of negative helicity gluons in those gluonic amplitudes is k. And it's a function of the kinematic variables that describe the scattering, which are conveniently given by these spinner helicity variables, lambda and lambda tilde. Maybe I'll use and there are some fermionic variables that also conveniently label them. So this definition of what the amplitudes are is manifestly local and unitary. That's its point. It comes from Lagrangians and the usual formalism of quantum field theory, which makes these things manifest. It's also famously horrendously complicated. On the right-hand side, we have an, on the face of it, completely different object. We have an integral over the space of k-dimensional planes in n dimensions. That's an integral over the Grassmannian gk, n, so the data is the same on the left and the right. These k-dimensional planes in n dimensions are, have the property that they're forced to contain a two-plane made out of all of the external particles. The lambdas of all the external particles form a two-plane in an n-dimensional space where n is the number of particles. The lambda tilde plane, the lambda and the lambda tilde plane are orthogonal, and you're supposed to integrate over all k-planes that contain lambda and are orthogonal to lambda tilde, and you're supposed to integrate over the space of k-planes in n dimensions with a very specific measure, which is going to play a big role in this talk, which I'll explain a little more in a second. But anyway, this is a completely different object. There's no path integral, there's no space-time, there's no unitarity. There's just a simple integral over planes in n dimensions. So it's definitely not manifestly local, definitely not manifestly unitary. It's certainly simple. The claim is that this object computes all the things that you need to reconstruct the amplitude, not just at tree level, but to all loop orders. Now, something that's of interest to this audience is this infinite-dimensional Yangian symmetry of n equals 4 super Yang mills in the planar limit. And one thing that this formulation does is make this Yangian invariance manifest. We'll understand a lot better in this talk where the Yangian comes from. But already, this formula makes it more or less manifest. This is something which is impossible with the standard Lagrangian formalism for an obvious reason. The Yangian symmetry involves seeing the conformal symmetries in both the original spacetime and the dual spacetime, but the Lagrangian singles one of those two pictures out, and so it makes it possible to see one conformal symmetry but completely hides the other one. All right, so I gave an introductory lectures to Grassmannians last week, which I hope many of you were at. But here's just a very crash course just for notation. In order to specify a k-plane in n dimensions, we have to give we can give a collection of k n-dimensional vectors whose span builds this k-dimensional plane. So I can assemble those k n-dimensional vectors into a k by n matrix. But if this matrix is to genuinely be about the plane, anything I do with this matrix, it better be invariant under arbitrary k by k linear transformations acting on it from the left. So there's a GLK redundancy in this description. Another bit of notation that you'll see everywhere is that we'll be therefore interested in things that are behave nicely under GLK. A subset of GLK, which is just SLK, the SLK invariants are built out of taking any of K of the columns of this K by N matrix and taking its determinant. So that's a so-called minor of this K by N matrix. There's a second way of thinking about of this K by N matrix, or a second way of thinking about this Grassmannian. Instead of thinking about it horizontally, you can think about it vertically as a collection of N K-dimensional vectors. So here I'm thinking about it as a collection of n k-dimensional vectors. In this way of thinking about it, it's important to remember that that we can rescale each column by an arbitrary amount that reflects just the little group symmetry of the amplitudes. And so in this way of thinking about it, a way of specifying a point in the Grassmannian, since I can rescale each one of these columns by any amount, is each one of these columns is actually a point in a projective k minus one dimensional space. And therefore, a given point in the Grassmannian is specified by giving some configuration of n points in a k minus one dimensional projective space. So here is a sort of simple generic one. We'll draw more interesting ones shortly. I think I'll stop using this. Does this work better? No. Okay. That's fine. Okay. All right. So so more precisely, this contour integral over the we have this contour integral over the Grassmannian. This just encodes that picture of momentum conservation that I alluded to earlier. Set in twister space, it looks even simpler and makes the superconformal symmetry manifest. And on the right-hand side, out of this object, we can extract the all-loop planar integrand for n equals 4 super Yang-Mills in a way that makes the Yangian invariance manifest. And if we want to look at less information on the left and the right-hand side, we can take residues. So this is to be interpreted as a multidimensional complex contour integral. And if we take the residues on the left-hand side, we get what we'll call here Grassmannian residues. On the right-hand side, the residues of the integrand are the so-called leading singularities of the scattering amplitudes. And so this was actually the original conjecture, that the Grassmannian residues are in one-to-one correspondence with these so-called leading singularities of the amplitudes to all loop order. So these guys also are claimed to generate all Yangian invariants, ignoring subtleties with collinear singularities. They're meant to generate all Yangian invariants, as well as all the relations between them, the relations between them following from residue theorems in this big contour integral. And on the right-hand side, so all of these Yangian invariants, of course, so these leading singularities are Yangian invariant, and all the remarkable linear relations between them encode things like locality and unitarity in the quantum field theory. Okay, so just to give you a flavor for how these things have been established, once you start studying this basic contour integral, you notice that there are some very simple operations for taking residues and building new residues out of them. For instance, you can take two of them, and if they don't share any particles in common, you can just multiply them. So we can call that the fuse operation. You can also remove particles, either in a way that decreases K or preserves K. We can add particles. So there's these very simple tinker toy operations that allow you to build new objects out of old. So this particular way of gluing things together, which in space-time you interpret as a leading singularity, from the point of view of the Grassmannian, is just a combination of the fuse, merge, and remove operations. And so this makes it manifest that all leading singularities are, in fact, residues of the Grassmannian integral, and are therefore Yangian invariant. There's also a picture for where loops come from. If you start with some, let's say, some tree-type object, and you want to hide some of the particles, you have, let's say, an amplitude with a huge number of particles, but you just want to look at a subset with a smaller number of them. Well, you can use these elementary operations to remove some of the particles. And there is a boring way of doing it, just removing them one at a time. But when you remove pairs of them, there's a canonical second way that you can do it, which integrates over the two particles. This is in the dual space in the so-called momentum twister form. This is a natural way of talking about it. You can remove them on a so-called entangled contour of integration, and that gives you what you interpret as a loop integral. So. So it's exactly the same operations, which done one at a time would just take you from trees to trees. Done in this entangled way gives you something that's interpreted as a loop integral. And so one can derive a generalization of the BCFW recursion relations for tree amplitudes that work to all loop order. And these can just be derived from field theory without making any reference to the Yangian or the Grassmannian or anything like that. There are two terms in this recursion relation. There's one term that encodes all the what looks just like the standard tree level piece, but there's a new term which encodes the loop quantum effects. And so one could, in principle, derive this without any reference to any of this business. But what's very interesting, of course, is that both the classical and the quantum terms have very simple interpretations in terms of these canonical operations on Grassmannian residues and Yangian invariants. And therefore, they're actually computationally most easily carried out in the Grassmannian. And this formulation makes it obvious that the all-loop not only allows you to compute the all-loop integrand, but makes it obvious that the object, at least at the level of the integrand, is exactly Yangian invariant. So this gives you a complete definition of the planar scattering amplitudes, making this infinite dimensional symmetry manifest, but where the words space-time, Lagrangian, path integral, gate symmetry, et cetera, don't make any appearance. And it's useful. So you can actually use it to compute the integrands that hadn't been computed before. All two-loop integrands for the simplest maximal helicity violating amplitudes can be computed from the recursion relations and cast in a variety of forms. These are the simplest forms that we found for them. All two-loop amplitudes are just one line, the top line. This is something which, with the fanciest techniques 2 years ago, was 8 pages, but it's just a single term. And all the other things on this page have just never been computed before. These are all the two-loop next MHV amplitudes that fits on a line. These are all the three-loop MHV amplitudes that fits on a line. And they arise naturally described in this momentum twistorial form, which has its origin in these Tinkertoy operations on Grassmannian residues. So clearly this is a powerful way of thinking about the loop integrand, but something that's gotten a lot of attention deservedly over the past 6 months or so is moving beyond the integrand to actually try to compute the integrals, the actual loop amplitudes themselves, and there's been a lot of progress on this. But I feel that the form of the integrand that's presented by this all-loop recursion is the form that begs to be integrated and is the form in which we should try to do the integrals, not using the standard methods, but using the methods that the problem is asking to be solved with. For example, this is not the form that we actually presented in our paper. It's something that we realized more recently. But the one-loop MHV the one-loop MHV amplitude that's spat out by the all-loop recursion relation has this sort of remarkable structure. It's an integral of 4D logs wedged together, okay, and summed over many terms. This is something which we said it's a general point that it looks like loop amplitudes are anomalies. This is a total derivative. It's actually a massive total derivative. It's a total derivative 4 steps in. It's a d. You would think that it's zero if you integrated it. It's not zero because of some subtlety with the contour of integration. And in fact, it has nothing to do with infrared divergences. This object is finite for generic I and J, and yet it's not equal to zero. It doesn't have to do with infrared divergences. It has to do with the fact that the real contour of integration that corresponds to integrating these points over a real space-time, because of the presence of those logarithms, induces boundaries inside that integral and lowers it from a four-dimensional integral to a two-dimensional integral that gives you dilogarithms. This seems very, very important. We need to, I think, understand how to think about this properly. But one thing which is certain is that this is a form which is being spat out from the recursion, from the way you jam residues together. So this is yet further motivation to try to understand what this Grassmannian object is better. All right, so that's what we're going to do in the remainder of this talk. So this is the outline for the rest of the talk. When I started making the talk, I was more ambitious for how much I thought I could cover. So there are things I'm going to skip in the outline. So instead of starting with some simple examples, I'm going to just jump directly. So we have this funny object, this integral of a Grassmannian. There's a variety of funny things in it. There's a cyclic structure. We have this funny measure. Where do all these things come from? So what I want to tell you about is a very simple geometry which is underlying all of this. And that underlying geometry actually has a name. It's been studied by mathematicians relatively recently. most intensively over the past 5 years or so, and is known as the so-called positive part of the Grassmannian, and it's associated with what we'll call a Grassmannian polytope. So I want to introduce you to this geometric space. This funny measure that we're talking about with this strange product of miners downstairs is actually a unique object. It's the unique smooth form on this space with only has singularities on its boundaries. And so all the residues, all the Yangian invariants are actually associated with faces of this polytope of appropriate dimensionality. And all the relations between these invariants is simply a boundary of boundary equals zero statement. So it just has a very simple geometric interpretation that I'll tell you about. I won't have time to tell you about how you interpret all physical objects like factorization channels, BCFW forms, even the loop integrand itself, how you interpret inside the Grassmannian. But I will jump to talking about something else that I think should have some interest to this audience, which is the origin of the Yangian symmetry. So in this picture, there's a completely obvious geometric symmetry, namely just diffeomorphisms on this positive space. That's it. That symmetry turns into the Yangian symmetry of the scattering amplitudes. So I'd like to tell you about that. Because, I mean, if someone woke me up in the middle of the night, put a gun to my head and said, why do n equals 4 amplitudes have Yangian invariants? I would not have any obvious answer. I wouldn't know how a dumb guy would come up with these strange generators that are supposed to annihilate the amplitude. But this picture, this is really the picture for the dumb guy. Every single thing here is incredibly simple. The space is extremely simple. The definitions are very simple. Of course, the outcomes are intricate and interesting. But the fact that the symmetry exists, what it is, and so on, is just completely obvious. And so I want to tell you about that. Huh? The one that we're talking about here, I don't know what the analog of that parameter is, but maybe. I think one of the experts in the audience here would be able to tell you. And finally, something else I won't have time to talk about, although I'd be happy to tell anyone afterwards who's interested. One of the real uses of this technology for us recently has been having this basic complete control over all the planar leading singularities of n equals 4. There's really some explicit formula for all of them. Allows us to much more easily begin a systematic exploration of what happens beyond the planar limit. And so there is some preliminary evidence for real magic that survives beyond planarity. And but I won't have a chance to talk about that, but I would be happy to tell people afterwards. Okay, so let's begin discussing this space. This is a part of the Grassmannian that started to be studied, I don't know the history perfectly, but by Lustig in the 90s, and more recently in the past 5 years or so by Posnikov et al., as well as Falk and Goncharov and many others. And as we'll see, that there are things that we can borrow, things that were learned about of the space from them, but also the physics and our n equals 4 intuition also tells us things about the space which are, I think, new and interesting to the mathematicians. All right, so the idea is simply to find a generalization of the simple picture of a simplex in a projective space. So how do we think about a simplex? Really, we're trying to define the inside of some region in a projective space in a natural way. So imagine here's an example in P2. So let's say you have three lines, and you want to figure out how to define the inside of that triangle. Okay, so there's very simple simplex. Well, a way of doing that is to pick coordinates, just choose coordinates x1, x2, x3. Of course, we have privileged directions 1, 2, and 3, which are given. These are the three lines, so we can choose our coordinates relative to those privileged directions. And now we can demand that the coordinates are positive. Of course, really, only the ratio of the coordinates is invariant. But since we're making all of them positive, we can just say they're all positive, just for simplicity. Okay. So So let's say we demand that they're all positive. Well, so here's a simple example. The ratio, I can say, put x1 to 1. So x2 is positive and x3 is positive, and I just get this upper quadrant. Okay? That upper quadrant is just projectively exactly the inside of a triangle. So that's the way to define an inside. That's the way to define the inside of a simplex, is to just say that the coordinates are positive. The closure of this thing is when the coordinates are non-negative, includes the boundary of the triangle itself. So the closure is a little polytope here, in this case just this dumb triangle. If we do it in a general projective space, the closure is a simplex, a general simplex. Now, in this case, it's particularly heavy-handed to label it this way, but since this is going to generalize, since we can freely rescale x1, x2, and x3, we can actually denote this simplex just by a collection of numbers, 1, 2, 3, up to n. It's just a normal way we would denote a simplex. And now going to the boundary corresponds to just putting any one of these variables to 0. Okay? So if I want to see what's in the boundary of 1, 2, 3, up to n, I just go through and I delete one of them at a time with some alternating signs. Okay? So in this case, So labeling the simplex itself is just 1, 2, 3, up to n, and the boundary operation is simply deletion. This is the standard notion of boundary, okay? Where you just delete one guy at a time. Of course, this boundary squares to 0. All right. So what we'd like to do is generalize this to a Grassmannian. And it's going to be convenient to think about the Grassmannian here in this vertical direction, where we think about it as n k-dimensional vectors. So let's think about this k by n matrix as n k-dimensional vectors. And now we're going to define the positive part to be the only generalization of the previous picture that we could have. We want the coordinates to be positive, but the coordinates don't have any GLK or SLK invariant meaning. The only invariant thing we can do is demand that the minors are positive. Okay, so I take the determinant of 1, 2, 7, and I demand that all those minors are positive. Yes, Pedro? Yes. Sorry. Thank you very much. This is a very important point. Right now, everything is real. It's very important everything is real. Okay. So if you like, we're going to a real slice, and we're going to find some interesting structure on the real slice that then has some implications for the complex case. But for almost the rest of the talk, everything's going to be real. Thank you very much. The reality is going to play a really crucial role here. Obviously, we can't talk about positivity. So I should have said that before. Thanks a lot, Pedro. All right, so we're going to demand that these minors are positive. Of course, since the minors have some anti-symmetry, this only makes sense if you give some ordering. Okay? So we demand that the minors are positive if we demand 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 7, et cetera, if they're just ordered in increasing order. They're all positive. Nowhere here have I said anything about a cyclic structure. Nowhere here have I said anything about consecutive minors, like 1, 2, 3 up to k, 2, 3, 4 up to k plus 1, nothing. We're just trying to define the most natural generalization of a simplex in a Grassmannian. Everything is positive, totally democratic. Everything is positive. Okay. The determinant. Yes, that's right. These minors, the minors, you take the k columns and you take the determinant.
The Plucker coordinates are positive.
Yes, that's right. We want all the Plucker coordinates, all the Plucker coordinates in some ordering to be positive. Okay. Right. Sure. No, but I mean, yes. Okay. Now, one nice thing happens right away. You would think that for any ordering you have of the external particles, for any permutation, you'd define a different positive part. But that's not true, because there's a natural twisted cyclic structure. If this matrix is arranged so that all the minors are positive, then if you just shift C1 to C2, C2 to 3, C3, and then the n guy, Cn, to minus 1 to the k plus 1, C1, then this new matrix also has all positive minors. Okay? And therefore, actually, if we have this big Grassmannian, the positive parts are associated with cyclic classes, cyclic orderings of external particles. So here is where just the cyclic ordering is the first emergent property here. Okay? So with given cyclic ordering, we have a different positive part. All right. So let's just look at a simple example. So let's say we're doing this in G2, n. So we have a bunch of two-dimensional vectors, which I'm imagining circling around a circle. Okay? What does it mean that each one of the miners is positive? Well, it just means that each one of these cross products is positive, which means that 1, 2 being positive means that 2 is a little bit to the right of 1. 2, 3 is positive means that 3 is a little bit to the right of 2. But 1, 3 has also got to be positive. So 3 has got to be to the right of 1. 3 can't have cycled too much around and come back to be to the left of 1. Okay? So that means that if you just draw what this configuration looks like, it looks like a picture with vectors going around the circle where they can't cross, they can't go around more than once. Okay? Right, so this defines what this configuration of vectors is in the positive part of the Grassmannian. But now we can ask what the closure looks like. What do the boundaries look like? When it was a simplex, the boundaries were trivial. We could just put any one of the coordinates to 0. Okay? But here the closure is going to be much, much more interesting. And this is the origin of all of this sort of this vastly richer object, this Grassmannian polytope. The reason is that I can't just randomly put any one of these miners to 0. For example, I can't just say what I want to do is put the miner 1, 3 to 0. If I put 1, 3 to 0, that means I want to make the vector 3 parallel to the vector 1. But I can't do it, because as I make 3 parallel to 1, 2 all the time has got to be in between the two of them and is accordioned between them. So as I try to make 3 parallel to 1, before I make 3 parallel to 1, I will necessarily make 1 parallel to 2 and 2 parallel to 3. Okay? So I can't randomly set these variables to 0. So here's where the reality plays a crucial role. All right? This is also easy to see in the projective way of thinking about this configuration. It's particularly transparent in this case. If I think about G2 comma N, as I said, we can now think of it as a collection of points in P1. This is the real projective space now, so they're on a real projective line. And being in the positive part really means that the points are ordered on this line, 1 in front of 2, in front of 3, in front of 4. And so it's again vivid that I cannot, for example, just put the minor 1, 3 to 0. As I try to put 1, 3 to 0, which is to make 3 and 1 land on top of each other, I necessarily squeeze 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 in the middle. Okay? So this actually gives us a picture, actually, for what the boundary does look like. So this is a generic configuration. Now I want to see what are the more special configurations. I want to go to the, in order to go to the boundary, well, the first thing that I can do in this picture is just merge any two of these particles. So I'm just giving you a representative for what you get at every level. So the first representative, I can merge 1 and 2, or I can merge 2 and 3, and so on. Okay? So that's the first level. Having done that, I can now go down, and I can do, well, I can, for example, merge 3 with 1 and 2 that was there already. Something else I can do at this point is actually delete 2. I can delete 2 because 2 is already parallel to 1. So to make one more special configuration, I can make that constant of proportionality vanish. So if 2 points are on top of each other, I can now delete 2. So this is another thing that I can have. This is another configuration. You see, this is a configuration with one more constraint. So it's a codimension 1 face of this region. This is a codimension 2 face of this region, and so on. Okay. So you see that this motivates a notion of a boundary operator, which does 2 things now, not just delete, which is what we had for the simplex, but allows us to merge and delete. Okay? And so you can see we can go down in 4 steps. We can go from here to there to there to there. And so whatever this object is whatever this positive part is a 4-dimensional region, and so it has some boundaries. So it's a 4-dimensional polytope of some sort. You can easily check that this boundary operator so defined squares to 0, so it's actually a legitimate boundary operator, even though it's not the one that you learn in books for acting on simplices. And there's actually a visual way to see how all of these things fit together. Okay? So this 1, 2, 3, 4 at the top is a 4-dimensional, is some 4-dimensional polytope. So this guy is one of its 3-dimensional faces. There's 4 other 3-dimensional faces. This is some 2-dimensional face of that 3-dimensional guy, okay? And these are a variety of 2-dimensional faces of it, and so on. So just to show you how they all fit together, I can try to draw them all together in an actual polytope. Now, I can't draw you a 4-dimensional polytope, but I can draw you what one of the 3-dimensional ones looks like. So this is what this is what the face, the three-dimensional face, 1, 2, and then 3, 4 on top of each other looks like. And I haven't drawn all of them, but it forms an octahedron. And what I mean by this is that a face of this octahedron is now this configuration, where 1 and 2, 3, 4 are on top of each other. An edge is this one lower dimensional guy where 1 and 2, 4 are on top of each other. I deleted 3. And then a vertex is where I further delete, for example, 4. So actually, I didn't draw them all in, but every single one of the terms in the boundary of this guy using the merge and delete operations can be fit into this beautiful octahedron. Okay. And so furthermore, so that very vividly shows you that, that what all these objects are, what the boundary operator is, makes it obvious that the boundary squares to 0 and so on. And then you can also visualize with a little bit of work how these three-dimensional guys actually fit into a big four-dimensional polytope. This is actually a polytope that was discussed by Gelfand and McPherson in the early 1980s, and it's the sort of simplest example of the Grassmannian polytope in G2,4. Okay. One remarkable thing that you'll see over and over again is that the whole four-dimensional polytope is actually topologically a ball. Okay. So that's not obvious at all, but these things glue together in a way that, that are topologically a ball. This three-dimensional face is clearly topologically a ball, but actually the whole four-dimensional thing is topologically ball. All these Grassmannian polytopes will be topologically ball. So a highly unobvious statement with no particularly transparent proof. Sorry? No, that's not known. I'll say specifically what I mean when I get to it. Okay, now, very important point. We started off just talking about this positive part of the Grassmannian, but we see, again, because everything was real, that something emerges. Classifying the boundaries, even though we didn't say anything about consecutive guys, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5 being important, going to the boundaries makes those consecutive minors important. And in fact, the boundaries precisely involved giving linear dependencies between change of two consecutive guys. Okay. So loosely, the structure that the consecutive minors, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4 matter, is just an automatic consequence of going to the boundary of this positive part of the Grassmannian. All right. And now, so that's a completely geometric characterization of what it is. You can also come up with a variety of nice coordinates to put on this positive part of the Grassmannian, so-called positive coordinates, where if the coordinates are positive or negative, uniformly positive or negative, if you give these coordinates and they're in a specific quadrant, then you're guaranteed to land in a positive part of the Grassmannian. So here's a particularly obvious set of positive coordinates in this case, just motivated by this picture on a projective line that 1 is in front of 2 is in front of 3 and so on. Well, if you just say that picture in equations, just putting 1 and 2 to a 2 canonical locations, then all we're doing is saying that here's 3, the Y3 is the overall scaling in this projective picture. Going from the projective picture to the 2 by n matrix, there's an overall scaling in front of each 2 vector. But we're just saying that this coordinate is in front of that one, the other one is in front of that one, and so on. Okay? So that coordinatization, saying that those coordinates are positive, actually in this case is the x's are negative, the y's are positive, but it doesn't matter, saying that those coordinates are positive guarantees that you're in the positive part of the Grassmannian. So it's a nice set of coordinates which parameterizes at least some chart of a positive part of the Grassmannian. For G2N, there are some other beautiful examples of coordinates like this. There are these so-called Fock-Gontcharoff coordinates that have shown up in many, many places. And so here, here it's a very different picture. Imagine taking the points 1, 2 up to n and triangulating this polygon any way you like. And you can now choose as positive coordinates the minors. So interpret each line as a minor. So 1, 3, just think of it as a minor, 1, 3, 1, 2 is a minor, 1, 2, and so on. So you just demand that all the minors that occur in that picture are positive. Okay? All those minors being positive guarantee that you're in the positive part of the Grassmannian. And therefore, they give you nice coordinates on the positive part. Okay. This first picture generalizes nicely to all KNN, which is why I'll talk about it more. All right, so just to get a little more of a feeling, let's go up to G3N. So in G3N, we can now think of it as configurations of points in P2. And now, being in the positive part of the Grassmannian has a very simple geometric interpretation that if you draw a line connecting 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, you just draw that polygon, that this polygon is convex. So you could, the polygon could look totally random, and then you're not in the positive part of the Grassmannian. But when the polygon looks convex, you're in the positive part of the Grassmannian. So once again, you can see that going to the boundaries, you can't make random minors vanish. Like, let's say I want to go to a more special configuration starting from the top guy. Well, let's say I want to make, I don't know, minor 1, 3, 5 vanish. So I take the point 3 and I send it screaming towards the line 1, 5. Well, tough luck. Before it hits the line 1, 5, it's going to make 2, 3, 4 collinear with each other. And so the minor 2, 3, 4 vanishes before you can ever get to the minor 1, 3, 5 vanishing. So you can see again, so this is what the first set of boundaries looks like. So you're just deformations of this polygon that keep it convex. Once I hit this one lower dimensional boundary, I can keep going. For example, I can merge 6 and 1 together. That's going one dimension lower and so on. But once again, you see as a completely emergent property, that it's the consecutive minors that matter. Setting the consecutive minors to 0 is what determines how you go to the boundary, even though we didn't put it in by hand. So the cyclic structure is emergent, and the fact that the consecutive minors matter is an emergent property of this positive space. And therefore, specifying a point on the boundary is determined by giving linear dependencies between change of 3 consecutive vectors. In general, finding the boundary of the space is specified by giving consecutive dependencies between k consecutive vectors. Once again, there are nice polygon coordinates for the positive part here as well, which is particularly obvious from the picture. If you look at what this picture looks like, you can see that the difference between consecutive vectors in this polygon is a two-dimensional vector that, as you go around the polygon, doesn't cycle around more than once. But that was precisely what specified the configuration of vectors in the one lower dimensional positive part of G2 comma n. So given what you've just constructed for the positive part of a one lower dimension of G2n, we can build a nice polygon coordinates for G3n. Okay? So this is explicitly what it is. And this very simply generalizes for all k and n. So now let's say we want to move beyond these examples, and we want to classify all of the configurations. As soon as you get beyond G3n, it starts getting very hard to visualize. For example, here's what some configuration in G4.9 looks like. 3 points are on a line. 4 is on a plane with them. There's another plane that contains 7, 8, 9, 5, 6, and 5, 6 happens to be on the intersection of those two planes. Okay? This is a picture which is perfectly specified by giving linear dependencies between sets of 4 consecutive vectors, one after the other after the other, but we need to figure out how to classify them. So it needs to be done systematically. So we had some ideas for how to do this, and I think it's sort of 85% solved the problem, but there are some special cases that we couldn't figure out. So Pierre Delien straightened this out. Okay. So this is Delien's strategy for completely classifying all such configurations. The idea is to first draw a table where you just give, if you have a configuration of k vectors, of n k vectors, you just draw a table where you just write the rank of, here's the rank of the vector, which is just one dimensional, 1. Then you write the rank that's spanned by C1 and C2. That's another number, the rank that's spanned by C1, C2, and C3, and so on. So you just build a table like this of all the possible ranks that are spanned by the vectors, the first one. And then just for visual aid, you draw the second one up one relative to the first one, the third one up another one, and so on. And the whole picture is cyclic in the horizontal direction. So if you had this configuration of vectors, you would build out of it this table. I won't go through it, but for example, starting at 1, you see we have 1, which has dimension 1. 1, 2 has rank 2, because there's 2 separate points. But 1, 2, 3 still has rank 2, because 1, 2, 3 are on the line. But once we get to 1, 2, 3, 4, you see it goes up to rank 3 and so on. Okay. So you can build a table like this, and this table obviously contains all the information of the configuration. If someone hands you this table, you can read off the configuration. If someone hands you the configuration, you can read off the table. But this table has an enormous amount of redundant information. And what Pierre realized is that there's an incredibly simple and tiny, compact amount of information in this table that you need to uniquely specify the configuration. And the observation is that in any column, the numbers are increasing as you go up, and the numbers are increasing as you go to the left, and that in any column, there's a unique spot which locally looks like a number, p, 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 and then the in the southeast corner, p minus 1. That happens uniquely once in every column, and everywhere it happens, you draw a hook through that location. So you go from a picture like this to just a picture of where the hooks are. In each place here, the red dot is where that configuration happened. So you just draw a line, vertical and then horizontal line, through where that hook happened. You put a little red dot where all the hooks are. And the claim is that the location of those red dots completely specifies the object. So if you specify where those red dots are, you've completely specified the configuration. And there's a number of nice things about it. The average height of the red dots is k. You can read off the dimensionality of the configuration. So I've also drawn black dots here, which are the set of all the intersections of these hooks with each other. So that's where the black dots denote all the intersections. The dimension of the configuration is just the number of the red dots and the black dots, and that's it. So the entire information is actually labeled just by a permutation, just sending the n guys here to the n guys that come out the other side as you follow the hooks. Okay? So it's an amazingly compact representation of all such objects. It's three because it's a three-dimensional configuration, right? We don't have any more than we don't have the whole thing is the whole rank. It's a three by n matrix. The maximal rank that you can have is three. So we're just drawing. So these numbers are the ranks of C1, C1, C2, C2, C3, and so on. So by convention, you just fill up the whole rest of you just keep going with the maximum k at the top. Okay, this is just to give you a flavor. Obviously, you're not expected to see this in the detail, but just so you see, there's a very, very compact representation. And with that compact representation, you can actually figure out what are all the configurations that are in the boundary of a given configuration. The boundary operator just goes through any one of these hook diagrams, looks anywhere which looks like this, which has a hook and another hook, okay? Such that there's no red dots in between. If I fill up the left-hand side to a whole square, there's no red dots contained in that square. Everywhere where it looks like that, you replace it. You replace that hook diagram with a new hook diagram on the right. You can easily see that this reduces the dimension by one, and so it finds all the guys that are on the boundary. Okay, so now we're done. Now we know geometrically how to characterize the whole thing. And for example, you can start in G5 comma 10, just to see that these objects are much, much richer than simplices, because these boundary operations are much more interesting than just deletion. So this is what the polytope looks like in G5 comma 10. It's 25 dimensional. You start at the top with one 25 dimensional face. Then you can you find all the 24 dimensional faces, 23 dimensional faces, and so on. So you make this table. So you see, it's a pretty intricate polytope with a huge number of faces in between. Something really remarkable you notice is that if you sum the Euler sum for the vertices minus edges plus faces and so on, you get exactly one. The sky's a ball. Okay. As I mentioned, this is true of all these Grassmannian polytopes. Utterly unobvious and very unenlightening proofs. But it has been proven, at least combinatorially, the vertices, edges, and faces all line up in such a way that the whole thing is actually a ball. Okay. Now, something I have zero time to talk about is that I showed you what these polygon coordinates look like that put you into the positive part of the Grassmannian in the interior. But it would be nice to know what these coordinates look like also on the faces. And this is not an obvious problem. But the analog of these polygon coordinates can be found that also describe what happens on all the faces. Now, this is something which is very closely related to coordinates that Posnikov had introduced to give this cell decomposition of the positive part of the Grassmannian. Okay. So in fact, we've made contact with that literature. But the point is that there's now there's a complete map between Deligne's notation, which is this completely geometric characterization of these configurations, and a specific gauge-fixed set of coordinates that allow you to specifically describe any residue you like. And that's something that we've established. All right, so that's what the positive part is. Now, I'm running out of time, but let me try to get to the tell you something about the sort of meat now. So this is the geometric space. Now I want to talk about what a natural measure is on this space. And the question you can ask is, suppose you're interested in some form on this positive part of the Grassmannian, which is non-singular on the interior. So it's a smooth form on the interior of this positive part, and only has singularities on the boundary. Okay? Now, once you phrase the question like this, it's obvious that if any such form exists, it has to be this one. It has to be the one that we wrote down. Okay? The reason is that the very first singularities you run into are just when are as we saw in our pictures, when the consecutive minors go to zero. Okay? So it certainly needs to have singularities there. It certainly needs to have singularities where every consecutive minor goes to zero. And once you do that, you're done. You have an object that has a perfect weights, everything is fine, you're done. That's the only thing it could possibly be. What is completely unobvious in this form is that this object has the correct singularities on all the lower dimensional faces of this polytope as well. That's a very unobvious fact. It's related to it's related to other unobvious facts in our investigation of how to compute residues with this object. But it's true. And one very striking way of seeing that it's true is the following remarkable identity. So we have this form on the left, which is completely invariant. It's set in a totally gauge invariant, GLK invariant geometric way. On the other hand, we have a nice set of coordinates for the positive part of the Grassmannian. So we can ask, what does this form look like in positive coordinates? And the answer is that the form is simply the product of all the logarithmic derivatives of every single one of the coordinates. So this form is just literally dp1 over p1 up to dpk n minus k over pk n minus k if the p's are the coordinates in any positive representation of the matrix. Okay? So the object on the left is totally geometric, but it's not obvious what all of its singularities are and that it has logarithmic singularities everywhere. The object on the right is coordinate dependent, but it makes it completely obvious what the singularity structure is and that this thing is totally non-singular inside the Grassmannian and all of its singularities are on the boundary. So summarizing again, this is this invariant way of talking about this measure. This is a coordinate dependent way, and they're good for different things. This makes the geometry manifest. It makes the coordinate independence manifest, but it does not make it manifest that its singularities are so refined to only have singularities on the boundary of this polytope. This form makes the things that are not obvious in the first form obvious in the second form, and vice versa. In fact, amusingly, Goncharov had written down this form for the special case of G2, n for his own independent reasons, and it took us a while to realize that they were the same thing because he had chosen specific coordinates, and we had this coordinate independent form, inverting the usual relationship between physicists and mathematicians. All right, but that's what this measure is. Okay? It's the unique form on the positive part of the Grassmannian with singularities only on the boundary. And the residues are then associated with facets of this big polytope of appropriate dimensionality. Okay? So you have to go to faces that have dimensionality 2n minus 4 if you're doing a computation in momentum space, or dimension 4k if you're doing a computation in momentum twister space. But and furthermore, there's a trivial mapping. If someone hands you a residue in the twister space or momentum space form, you just drop the height of all these hook diagrams in the Deligne notation by 2 to go down to momentum twister space. So all the mappings are perfectly nice. But it gives us, finally, an explicit formula for any residue, for any Yang-Yin invariant. Given a particular geometric configuration classified by the Adelian residues, this is the explicit formula. Okay. The reason it's trivial is that in these positive coordinates, the measure is just d logs. So taking residues is totally trivial. You just drop all of the d logs that aren't there, and going down to the facet that you're interested in. But then the non-trivial action isn't in the measure. The non-trivial action is in how to reconstruct this matrix as a function of those coordinates, but which is something, as I said, that we know exactly how to do. So this is it. This is then as explicit a formula as you can have for any Yang-Yin invariant or any residue of this Grassmannian integral. You just solve for all the undetermined coordinates from this delta function. There's no integral actually to do. It's all just one big Jacobian. And as I mentioned, the relation between all the residues, all the relations simply come from going to a face that has dimension one higher. So if you're doing a momentum twister calculation, you go to faces that have dimension 4k plus 1, and then you just sum over all the faces that are in the boundary of that one higher dimensional face. And the sum of all those residues is equal to 0. That's the identity. So as a random example that just shows how non-trivial these identities can get, here's a 14-term identity that you get starting from the boundary of this object, which is a one higher dimensional thing. Okay, it's a sum of 14 terms. There's an explicit formula for every one of those 14 terms. Many of them are rational, but two of them involve solving a quadratic equation. One of them involves solving a cubic equation. There are non-trivial polynomials inside those C's. The fact that quadratic and cubic equations arise is not surprising from the point of view of leading singularities, because you're solving all of these polynomial equations to determine where the internal cut momenta are. So this is a 14-term identity that involves a bunch of rational terms, a bunch of cube roots, some of a bunch of square roots, and of course, dutifully, they all add up to 0. You can check that it's 0. It's true. All right. So finally, let me just in 3 minutes explain. So the summary of everything so far is there is this positive space. There's a unique form on this positive space, and we understand everything about it now. So we understand all of its residues, an explicit formula for all the Yang-Yin invariants. And so now, finally, why would we even know that there is a Yang-Yin symmetry from this picture? And the claim is that the Yang-Yin is nothing other than the diffeomorphisms that preserve the positive part of this space. And so this is the most obvious symmetry of the geometry. So what do I mean by this? Let's imagine that we're in G3N. So we have these, being in the positive part means that you have this polytope. It means that you have this polygon, which is convex. So let's just imagine doing diffeomorphisms on it. So we can just move the points around. Everything is fine so long as the polytope stays convex. Okay? But whatever you're doing, somehow it should have the property that as you put 4 and 3, 4, 5 start becoming collinear, that it should stop you from further pushing 4 in to make the polygon not convex. Okay? So whatever these diffs are need to have this nice property that as they move the points around, right as 3, 4, 5 becomes collinear, you can't go further. So minimally, it needs to have the property that whatever variation I do on the points, a variation of a consecutive minor should vanish when this consecutive minor vanishes. Now, the most trivial variations, diffs that you could have, are linear in these variables, but those are just GLK symmetries. We don't care about them. The first non-trivial variations are quadratic in the variables, and a little bit of thought shows this is the most general form that you could imagine having. I won't go through it in detail, but it's a quadratic variation that you can have in each one of these vectors. And then simply demanding, nothing other than demanding that the variation of a consecutive minor vanishes when the consecutive minor vanishes, completely fixes the form of this variation. And it completely fixes it to be this form that starts looking familiar to people who play with Yang-Yin symmetries, the sums over A less than B and stuff like that. Okay? And there's this, and there are some parameters, and this parameter has to satisfy that it's orthogonal to all these vectors for it to all to work. So this is the minimal condition, but it does not remotely guarantee that these diffs leave the act nicely in the positive part. It was just a condition involving the first cyclic minors. This does not remotely guarantee it, you would think. For example, here's a funny situation. This configuration, all of the cyclic minors vanish, actually. all the cyclic miners vanish, and yet you could still get into trouble. As you move this 0.78 around, as it approaches that line again, you could be in danger of making a concave polygon. So whatever the variation is must be such that it vanishes. The variation, let's say, of this minor 571 vanishes exactly as 571 goes to zero. That's something that's not true in general. It's not true for generic points. But somehow, in this special configuration, it had better be true. Now we have no more freedom. Okay? Now it either works or it doesn't. And of course, it works. Okay? So this is an extra remarkable set of things that happens. This extra remarkable set of things is really the same non-trivial fact that the measure with the cyclic miners, which was the unique form that we could get, happens to work and actually determines everything also and puts singularities only on the boundaries of this polytope. So that's it. There's a completely obvious symmetry of the positive part, the diffeomorphisms that preserve the positive part. We determine how it acts on the Cs, and of course, that action on the Cs is exactly the translation onto the Grassmannian of what the Yang-Yin generators are acting on delta 4/4. Okay, so in fact, if you do this on any function of delta 4/4, any integral delta 4/4 C dot W, the Yang-Yin generators on this turn precisely into the generator we were talking about on the Cs, and only for the correct positive part of the Grassmannian that we define does this annihilate the answer. So this obvious diffeomorphisms of the positive part is the origin of the Yang-Yin symmetry. All right, so let me conclude. So we've seen, I think, a remarkable relationship between Grassmannian polytopes, which, as I hope you see, were the simplest generalizations of simplices, and planar n equals 4 amplitudes. There's this unique form with singularities only on the faces of the polytope. Integrating this form against this picture this kinematic picture gives us residues that are localized to the faces of the polytope of appropriate dimension, so we can compute all of them. And the obvious diffs of this polytope ensure that all of these objects are Yang-Yin invariant. So what I didn't have a chance to discuss is the polytope interpretation of the loop integrand and various other objects, in particular, sort of beginning of an idea of how you think about the loops, not as integrals over space-time, but integrals over configurations inside the Grassmannian itself. And as I mentioned, using this technology to start exploring non-planar leading singularities and starting to see, at least to me, very surprisingly rigid structure there that suggests there's really some magic that survives beyond the planar limit. I just want to say one tiny word beyond planarity. This is something often that people outside this, skeptics like to say all this wonderful stuff going on in n equals 4 is all a consequence of just the planar limit. Nothing's going to survive beyond the planar limit and so on. But there's clearly something very wrong about this because we know n equals 4 has more magic in it beyond the planar limit, not less. The more magic it has is S-duality. S-duality is something that's invisible in the planar limit. So I don't know how it's going to show up in scattering amplitudes, but we need more magic, not less, beyond the planar limit. And perhaps related to that is something there's really zero time to talk about, but there's a remarkable fact that this exact same basic mathematical structure, positive parts of the Grassmannian and their generalizations, have shown up in a completely different context, in the totally different context of wall-crossing phenomenon in n equals 2 theories, and Hitchin systems and all of that wonderful stuff. And there, it's exactly the same basic space. And there, all the magic is about S-duality, actually. So we have no idea at the moment precisely how these things are connected to each other, but it's very striking that exactly the same structures are showing up in both cases. All right, thank you very much.
Yes, so the Yang-Yin is a very interesting example of a Hopf algebra, and it has a co-multiplication, and when it acts on tensor product of two objects, there's a way to do that, which is called this co-multiplication. Does that mean something here? Is there a simple interpretation of that?
Probably does. I don't know it, but I don't know. It would be nice for this, people especially. Everyone that we talk to makes a big deal about this Hopf algebra structure. and it's and we have seen zero teeth of this of any use in looking at the amplitudes. Now maybe we're looking at it wrong, but it would be great to see how this. For example, there's a claimed Hopf algebra structure just in the BCFW recursion relations at tree level, but. I haven't figured out whether it's tautological, trivial, interesting, what. So it would be nice to see if it actually means something useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have two questions. First of all, this Deleen classification of the collinearities.
Yes.
Does that coincide with the cell structure of the positive?
It does.
Equation?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that if you like is so. The history is a little bit funny because the way the positive part was actually characterized by at least the mathematical literature that we know of through to Posnikov was very much in a coordinate dependent way, and it's certainly not transparent if it's realized at all that what you're doing is classifying chains of k consecutive guys, okay, linear relationship between k consecutive guys. They just set the algebraic problem of determining all the minors to be positive, and they solved that problem. And so they came up with a nice set of coordinates, and that gave it a cell decomposition. Our picture was totally different. It was a geometric picture to begin with that argued that you should look for linear relationships between k consecutive guys. And so Deleen's classification just solves that problem. And then, in a sense, what shows the equivalence explicitly is the map that we found between a Deleen notation and explicit Posnikov / polygon variables for that thing. So that I think totally establishes that all these things are equivalent to each other. But they're really these two different points of view. There was this completely more geometric GLK invariant point of view, which, as I said, ironically is the point of view that we as physicists stumbled on. And there was a much more coordinate dependent point of view, which was what was developed by the mathematicians.
I
should say, though, that it was Posnikov et al. with this coordination really completely classified this all the faces of this polytope. They used it to do this count of all the vertices, edges, and faces to show very remarkably that these objects, at least combinatorially, satisfied the Eulerian conditions to be combinatorially a ball and so on. So there's some incredible properties of this polytope. But it was done from this very coordinate dependent point of view.
The other question was just about the theorem which expressed the volume form as the product of logarithmic differentials. Those P's, are they just the Hook Plücker coordinates?
Are they the what?
The Hook diagram Plücker coordinates.
No, they're not. No.
Then what are they?
They're not even unique. There are many different parameterizations of the positive part of the Grassmannian. For example, in G2N, I gave you these polygon coordinates and also the Fock-Gontarov coordinates. They look totally different. And yet, in either set of coordinates, our measure turns into the product of all of the D-logs. So it's not even unique.
But they are affine coordinates, right?
Yes, they are.
There's many. Okay, when I say Hook diagrams, I mean with respect to the standard big cell. So that's the same thing as the affine coordinates. The Hook Plücker coordinates coincide with the affine coordinates if you take your reference as the big cell.
I don't think so. Well, we can maybe talk about it later, but I don't think it's that. It's quite that simple.
So, is there any relation between the real structure that you're putting on the Grassmannian and the real structure that you might want to put on space-time or the twister space?
Of course, most obviously, doing everything for the real Grassmannian was perfectly tailored to 2-2 signature. It's certainly not obvious that this is the ultimate way of thinking about what this measure is or the form is or anything like that. Because clearly we're doing something on the real part, then we get this form, and then what we really do with it is lift it to something complex and think about it in the general complex case. It would be wonderful if there was an intrinsically complex way of understanding what's special about this form. I don't know what that is, but of course, as you know, the most obvious answer to your question, if you're going to stick in the real Grassmannian, then work with 2-2 signature. But I think none of us want to do that. So.